Hello everyone, welcome back to the History Hit Warfare Podcast. I'm your host, James Rogers, and as you know, each week, twice a week, I bring you brand new original episodes on military history. But once a week, I like to delve deep into the Dan Snow's History Hit archive and pull out an episode, a bonus episode, that needs a bit of attention. And as we approach Trafalgar Day later this month, I wanted to dig out an excellent episode with Andrew Baines, who's curator of HMS Victory. He talks to Dan about the events of the 21st of October 1805, about the ship, the Battle of Trafalgar itself, and of course the man who won it, Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson. So here is Dan and Andrew on the Battle of Trafalgar.
Well, we're recording this on Trafalgar Day, on the 21st of October. Let us talk. You're the curator of HMS Victory. Let's first of all talk about Victory, because Trafalgar was not its first rodeo. Victory has a long history before Trafalgar, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Victory's story really begins almost half a century before Trafalgar, during the Seven Years' War. When the decision is made that the Royal Navy needs some new ships and needs them pretty quickly. And so work starts on what is going to become Victory and is, at the time, the largest warship in the world. So when they start building the ship, there is an expectation, and she has a reputation, and she's almost famous, if you like, before she's even floated out. The problem we have as far as Victory's concerned is that she actually never serves in the Seven Years' War, because she's named for 1759, the year of victories, and in particular a fantastic naval victory at the Battle of Quiberon Bay, where the French fleet is effectively put out of action as far as we're concerned. The downside for Victory is, although she gets a nice shiny name, there's now not a need for her. And so the Royal Navy dials back the work on construction, and she's only floated out 2 years after the war ends. And she's then placed immediately in reserve, and she sits in reserve for 13 years.
And then a war presents itself, the American War of Independence, and she serves in that war. When does Nelson begin his association with HMS Victory?
Nelson, there's nice stories about Nelson going down to join the Navy and seeing Victory off Chatham. I'm not sure how true they are. Nelson's presence and association with Victory really begins towards the end of the 18th century. Victory is the flagship of an admiral called John Jervis, at a very famous battle, the Battle of Cape St. Vincent. And actually, that's when, immediately after that battle, St. Vincent writes about Victory being badly decayed, and every time somebody steps off the ladder above his deck, the whole ship shakes, and you can see the sea through the seams, and it really recommends that she should go for breaking up. So Nelson's association with Victory was almost a very, very brief one.
But she was kept on, and so presumably extensively rebuilt.
Yeah, so after the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, the decision is she's probably not worth the cost of repair. So they intend to use her as a hospital ship. And we're talking in late 1797 into 1798 at this point. That's not too bad as far as the ship structure is concerned. They take the guns out of her and she's filled with cots and hammocks for people in need of medical attention. Then the decision is made that they're going to convert it to a prison ship, and that would have been the end of the line. That's big holes made in the ship's side, and really it would have been inconceivable that she could have been returned to service economically. It would have been much cheaper and quicker, in fact, to build a new ship. So there's some debate over whether or not that should be done. Events intervene on Victory's behalf. The Royal Navy loses a couple of ships, and so in 1800 they decide that they are going to take her through what was estimated as a middling repair. So a fairly significant repair that's probably going to take her a year or so. In point of fact, it turns into a great repair, as they're known. Victory is very extensively modified. Large sections of the planking and the decks and the hull are replaced. But she's brought forward in 1803, just as the war, which had we'd had a peace, the war is clearly, or a war is going to start again, and Nelson needs to select a flagship. And Victory, which has a reputation as a fast sailer, is available. And so again, just circumstances collide, and Nelson is able to select Victory as his flagship to take her out to the Mediterranean.
We should say, what proportion of HMS Victory is material from the original build beginning in 1759?
Very, very little is the answer. We've got some sections of the keel, the majority of the keel, so for some bomb damage from the Second World War, and elements of the transom timbers. These are the timbers that are at the back of the ship, that if you stand alongside, you can see those wonderful stern galleries, all the windows and the carved work. The fundamental structure underlying that is very, very old indeed, and is likely to date to the ship's construction. Beyond that, she's very, very much like an individual. Every cell in our body, I believe, is replaced at least once every 20 years. Victory's kind of the same. From the moment you shake the squirrel out of the tree, she begins to decay. So in the 13 years immediately following her floating out, having cost £65,000 to build, just over £20,000 is built maintaining her, and that's taking rotten bits out and putting new bits in. So by the time she goes to sea with a crew in her, 30% is not original, if you like.
And then, of course, she had to be extensively rebuilt after Trafalgar, and we will see why. Give me a sense of the awesome power of an early 19th century three-decker ship of the line.
The three-decker at the time is the most complex object built by the human race up until that time. So it's industrially extremely complex. They're extremely expensive to build. They are the absolute pinnacle. There are not very many of them because they are so expensive. They have a firepower unlike anything else afloat. So they give you the opportunity to totally dominate. And people who are at the Battle of Trafalgar, who are serving in the ship, who have seen battle, write about the experience of battle, especially from the middle gun deck, where you have the lower gun deck below you, you have the guns around you, and you have the upper gun deck above you. And it is unlike anything they have seen before, and in many cases are really able to describe. They write about their inability to describe what it's like to be on these ships in the heat of battle. The downside is they do have a tendency to sail a bit like a haystack. They're not easy to manoeuvre, and they're not quick. So Victory, because she's a three-decker and she has a reputation for being a good sailor and a fast ship, that is one of the reasons Nelson picks her.
We should say, I think it's every battle that the Duke of Wellington fought, or Sir Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington fought in the Peninsula in southern France. It's not until the Battle of Waterloo that his army has more cannon than are present on HMS Victory. So that gives a sense of the firepower of just one of these battleships.
Yeah, absolutely. Victory is a 104-gun ship. As you say, that is an extraordinary number of guns, and it's one that an army commander in the field, until 10 years later, would not imagine being able to present it. And Victory is one ship, admittedly a very large ship, but one of 27 ships in the British fleet at the Battle of Trafalgar. The majority of them are 74-gun ships. So, again, the cost of operating these things, the cost of building them and manufacturing them and supporting them at sea is extraordinary. And we're very lucky, I suppose, through geographic circumstance in the UK, that we have the choice to invest in the Navy and the Army to a certain extent. Took a little bit of a back seat, you know, discuss. I'm sure if you were speaking to someone at the National Army Museum, they might disagree with me there. But in terms of financial requirement operating these fleets at sea, there's very, very few countries that can do it, and nobody else can really do it on the scale that Great Britain is able to do it at this time.
Well, cut a long story short, Napoleon has an army of invasion in northwest France. There's a lot of toing and froing, to say the least. But in October 1805, Nelson is on HMS Victory outside Cadiz. What's he doing there, and what's his plan?
Nelson's intention, Nelson's job really is to make sure that that fleet is not able to operate. And you can do that in two ways. You can either keep it in harbour, and that would require a close blockade to be quite close to the shore. The risk you run there is that the weather can always intervene, and if you're blown off course, the fleet, your opponent, can get out and lose you, ditch you, if you like, and that's a risk. Or you can keep a distant blockade, which allows you to understand what's going on, but also may tempt your opponent out, and that's really what Nelson wants to do. Nelson's not that interested in sitting around. He's already been doing it for 2 years, 2.5 years almost, in the Mediterranean. It's not terribly exciting. He wants a battle of annihilation. So his whole approach is to draw the French and Spanish out. There's various things happening on the continent, as you suggest. It looks like there's going to be things happening in Italy. So he's pretty confident that the admiral in charge of combined fleets, Villeneuve, is going to have to sail. So if he's going to have to sail, he wants him to get to a position where Nelson can fall on him and destroy him. He doesn't want a marginal victory. One or two ships captured isn't going to be enough. Giving Villeneuve the opportunity to get back into port is not going to be enough. He wants to destroy him. So to do that, he's 50 miles away, and he's relying on a chain of frigates, small single deck ships, in many ways the workhorse of the fleet, to keep him up to date. They form a signalling chain, if you like. They're stationed from horizon to horizon, so they can just see one another, and they will signal from Cadiz all the way out to Nelson in Victory and keep him up to date with what is happening. That's their role. So his intention is to monitor what's happening, and when the opportunity presents itself, lure the French and Spanish fleet to where he wants it and then fall upon them and destroy them.
And the destroying is the key, because explain to me, how does Nelson deploy his fleet in a very unorthodox way? What's his plan for the Battle of Trafalgar?
Nelson's plan is unusual, and he's spent quite a lot of time thinking about it. And whilst he's been in London in August and early September of 1805, he's been talking to a lot of people about it. And in fact, one of the museum's newest acquisitions, in fact, we've only just obtained this object on Wednesday last, is one of only two known sketches of Nelson's plan for the Battle of Trafalgar. So that's quite a nice, exciting thing we've been able to come across. So whereas traditionally a battle at sea between opposing fleets would be fought very simply in nice long lines where you range up against one another and fire away until either the weather separates you, night falls and fleets drift apart, you run out of ammunition, or the opposing fleets are able to outmaneuver one another and sail away. That's how battles are going to be fought. They don't give you outright overwhelming victories. In many ways, you might argue they're a bit of a damp squib. That's not to do the people who were fighting them in the disservice, but you don't get an overwhelming victory. That's not good enough for Nelson. He wants this battle of annihilation. So instead of sailing parallel to the combined fleet, he's going to sail directly towards them. And he's not going to be in one line of ships. He's going to split his fleet into two divisions, as it's termed. And his intention is to sail directly towards the enemy line. That runs a risk because it means they're able to shoot at him for a lot longer to start with than he's able to shoot at them. But it does mean he can close on them quickly. He then wants to cut through their line at about the halfway point, and then at about three quarters of the way towards the back of their line, and then overwhelm the back end of the enemy fleet. And he can do that because he will have numerical superiority. The front of the French and Spanish fleet, the van as it's termed, is now going to have to turn around, which, when you're in a sailing ship, takes quite a long time. And he expects to obtain his victory, defeat the rear of the line, and then be in a position to overwhelm the van of the enemy should they decide to engage him. That's his plan. He set it out at the Admiralty. He's described it to the King, and he's described it to his captains over two nights on the 28th and 29th of September 1805. He's also briefed them in a memo as to how he expects this battle to be fought.
There are stories to tell, myths to explore, legends that shaped the medieval world to captivate the imagination. I'm Matt Lewis, and with my co-host, Dr. Kat Jarman, I've gone medieval. We're waiting here for you to join us. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and let everyone know that you've gone medieval with History Hit.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The downside with that plan is there's a period of extraordinary vulnerability for the lead ships of the British fleet. Can you explain why?
There is. So when the sun rises on the morning of October 21st, the French and Spanish fleet is stretched out in a line about 5 miles long, and it's slightly concave, this line, so it's further away in the middle than it is at the ends. And Nelson is sailing in two lines directly towards it. And that means the 33 ships of the French and Spanish fleet can all fire at the two leading ships of the British fleet. So Nelson in Victory and his number two, Cuthbert Collingwood, in Royal Sovereign, know they're going to be exposed to fairly withering fire for quite a long time when they come in range of the enemy. And because the guns of a line of battleship are mounted on the broadside, on the side of the ship, they are not going to be able to return fire because they are head-on to the enemy. So it's only when they are able to punch through the line and then turn and fall upon individual ships that they will be able to return fire. And that's the risk. It exposes you to an awful lot of fire for quite a long time. And that risk is magnified on October the 21st because the winds are very squally, they're quite light, and Victory with Nelson and Royal Sovereign with Collingwood are closing on the enemy at about a walking pace. So Victory's under fire for well over 40 minutes before she's able to return fire with a reasonable degree of force.
And talk me through those 40 minutes. It was a a terrifying time to be on Victory.
It is. And Nelson, there's only one way he knows how to lead, and that's from the front. So he's out in front with Victory at the head of his line. Collingwood in Royal Sovereign is a little way ahead of him, actually, and he's the first to smash through the French line. But Nelson and Hardy, his captain on Victory, and the sailors of Victory, just really have to sit and wait as she painfully moves towards the enemy. And every once in a while, one of the French and Spanish ships will fire a ranging shot at Victory. It's actually very difficult for the French and Spanish gunners because of the swell, this roll, which makes it difficult to aim. But occasionally you'll hear the crack of a gun in the distance and the sound of one of these cannonball hurtling overhead like an express train. And then one gun finds the range and puts a shot through one of the sails of Victory. And the accounts write that nothing happens for about 30 seconds. And then there's a half dozen French and Spanish ships all open up, all concentrating on Victory. So you are looking at, across those six ships who show, probably a ton to a ton and a half of cannonballs being fired at Victory every 4 or 5 minutes. Now they're still aiming into the rigging, but the range isn't the range is difficult for them. The swell's difficult for them, and occasionally they get a hit on Victory. So the first person to be killed on Victory is Nelson's personal secretary, a man named John Scott, who's cut in two by a cannonball. Then a double-headed shot that's intended to take down Victory's masts and rigging and slow her down and prevent her from moving. A double-headed shot cuts through a line of Royal Marines, killing 8 of them. Another cannonball smashes into some of the rails on Victory and passes between Nelson and Hardy, throwing splinters all over. And indeed, one of those splinters tears the buckle off Captain Hardy's shoe, and the survivors who were there write about both men stopping and staring at one another, disbelieving that they've escaped uninjured. And this is when Nelson passes one of the more famous remarks, that this work is too warm to last very long, Hardy. It's a very, very dangerous period for the men of Victory, especially those men exposed on the decks with Nelson in his full uniform, who really has set out his expectations for battle and in many ways doesn't have a lot to do now. That's one of the peculiar things about Nelson's situation. He's got his fleet where he needs it, when he needs it. He's explained his expectations to the captains of the ships of that fleet. The men are well trained, they are well provisioned, they know what's expected of them. So the die has been cast. So he's pacing back and forth, largely dictating his post-battle report at this time.
And then HMS Victory crashes through the French and Spanish line. And give me a sense now, the range at which the action is taking place and the impact of HMS Victory's guns at that moment.
So Nelson is looking for the French flagship. He wants to hit the French flagship because, unlike his approach, which is to make sure everybody knows what he expects of them, and then in battle accept that it's smoky and you can't read flag signals, and a ship might be knocked out, which would mess up your command and control system. The French have an approach which is very, very, very precise in who can give orders and when they'll give orders. And they all come from the flagship. So he's aiming to knock the French flagship, Villeneuve's flagship Bucentaur, out, take down its masts and rigging, put it out of action, and then he expects the French command and control system to fall apart. So he's been aiming for a ship that he thinks is the French flagship, and it turns out it's not. He's been aiming for the Santissima Trinidad, a Spanish ship. When the French flagship breaks out its colours, Hardy executes almost the equivalent of something like a handbrake turn at sea, and readjust Victory's course for Bucentaur. And the French have an inkling of what's about to happen. So their ships are very, very close together in a line. And the ship that's next to stern in the line of Bucentaur, the French ship Red Utaba, is so close that its bowsprit keeps grazing the stern of Bucentaur. They want to keep them together to make sure there's not room to push through the line, so that if Nelson wants to try to do that, he has to have a collision broadside on broadside. A small gap, however, opens up between the French flagship and the next ship astern, the Red Utaba. And Captain Hardy asks Nelson, should he try for the gap, or should he go in front of the flagship? Nelson tells him it doesn't much matter. It's up to him. A very fateful decision, because Hardy then decides to go for the gap. And he punches through in between Bucentaur, which, just like Victory, had these beautiful stern galleries, glass windows. Now all the glass has been removed, preparing for battle. But as each of Victory's guns on the broadside, over 50 guns, passes the back of the French ship, they fire, and they have been double and triple shotted with cannonball and K-shot. And K-shot is something that transforms the guns into effectively an enormous shotgun. That is discharged into the stern of Bucentaur in a devastating fire. There's over 1.5 tons of metal leaving the side of Victory in this broadside. And that really puts paid to Villeneuve. He's alive on the deck, but many of his gun crews have been killed. Many of his guns have been dismounted. And really, his ability to influence events now going forward has ceased to exist. The problem we have on Victory is that the next ship astern of Bucentaur is Red Utaba. And she is commanded by Captain Luca. And Luca has very, very thoroughly drilled his men in close quarters fighting and boarding. And Victory and Red Utaba become locked together, their masts and rigging tangled together. And these two ships fall out of the line, and Victory is now really in a very, very precarious position up against this very, very, very competent opponent.
And quite soon, Nelson pays the ultimate price for allowing Hardy to make that decision.
He does. Hardy and Nelson are continuing to pace the quarterdeck of Victory. And as I say, Nelson has been dictating notes for his post-battle report, firstly to his own secretary, and then when John Scott is killed, to Hardy's secretary. And Hardy's a little way distant from him, surrounded by smoke and the noise of battle, and the six guns on the quarterdeck of Victory are being fired. When Nelson is hit by what we now refer to as a sharpshooter, that makes it sound almost like a sniper. It's not that. These are the crew of the French ship Red Utaba up in the rigging of that ship, firing down onto the decks of Victory. And there's great debate over whether was Nelson specifically targeted because he was in his uniform with his medals and sequins. Actually, there's a certain degree of evidence that suggests from the angle of the shot he was hit by a rebound. Either way, a musket is discharged from a distance of about 15 metres, so really very, very close. That fires a ball of lead almost 3/4 of an inch across, so getting on for 2 centimetres across, which strikes Nelson on the left shoulder. It pierces his shoulder, passes through the lung, severs a branch of the pulmonary artery, passes through his backbone, breaking his back, and lodges in the muscle under his right shoulder. And he's knocked to the deck, falls to the deck. And Hardy rushes over to him, and he's greeted by an exclamation of, "They have done for me at last, Hardy. My backbone is shot through.
Nelson's carried below, and the situation of is pretty precarious for Victory. But then, just before we deal with Nelson, tell me what happens when the fighting Temeraire joins the line and inflicts almost unimaginable or has an almost unimaginable impact.
Absolutely. Things are very, very precarious for Victory. The men on the deck have been exposed to this fire now for well over an hour on the run in, then as they've smashed through the line. And as well as having trained his men to be sharpshooters aloft, Luca of the Red Etarbe has trained them and has them supplied with grenades. And these are iron spheres, 2 or 3 inches across, that have a fuse and a detonating charge. He's trained them with papier-mâché versions of these grenades. He occasionally has taken them ashore to show them what it's like to use a real one and what it feels like when they go off close to you and how to use them. And these grenades have been raining down onto Victory's decks to such an extent that within a few minutes of Nelson being carried below, Victory's upper decks are almost clear, and she has to stop firing, and men from the gun decks come up on deck to try and push back boarders that it looks like are going to be coming over from Red Etarbe. However, Red Etarbe's men are so well trained they continue with the grenades, and the men that have come up from below are driven back below on Victory, and it looks like we're about to be boarded. And indeed, the first of the French boarders are beginning to clamber up onto Victory's forecastle. When the ship astern of her in the line, the fighting Temeraire goes around and comes alongside on the disengaged side of Red Etarbe, firing a carronade, one of the heaviest guns that the British fleet has, into the exposed French crew on the decks of Red Etarbe, on the bow of Red Etarbe, and then backing that up with a broadside. And less than an hour later, Captain Luca has to surrender. And out of a crew of almost 650 men on that French ship, only 100 of them are left fit. He's got 550 men who are killed and wounded. So that gives you an indication of the horrendous punishment they've taken at the hands of Temeraire and also of Victory's broadside guns. Both Victory and Temeraire had to depress their guns and point them down as they were pointing out of the gun port to avoid their cannonballs passing through the French ship and hitting a fellow British ship on either side. So horrendous conditions during the battle for Red Etarbe at this time.
Casualty figures on a par with what you might see on the first day of the Battle of Somme in some of those regiments.
Absolutely.
Let's wind things up. It's a bit unpleasant, but both for Nelson and for the battle. Nelson's below deck. He's below the waterline. How long does he linger for?
He lingers for around 3 hours, depends on which sources you are looking at. He's carried down below. Beatty the surgeon is he's just amputated a limb. He's examined Lieutenant Ram, who was a close friend of his and found him to be dead. He's a queue of about 30 men waiting to be seen when, from further along the orlop deck on Victory, he hears cries of, "Mr. Beatty, the Admiral is here. Mr. Beatty, the Admiral is wounded." And he moves forward to find Nelson, or at least a figure, being carried down the stairs. And this figure is their head and their chest is covered with a handkerchief, which Nelson has specifically instructed should be done because he didn't want the sight of him being carried through the gun decks to have a negative impact upon the morale of the crew. And as this handkerchief slips, Beatty realises who it is, rushes forward to help him being carried to Victory's side. But Nelson says, "Doctor, there is nothing that can be done for me," and again reiterates that his backbone's been shot through. He describes feeling a spurt of blood into his breast every time his heart beats. So Beatty's typical approach to a gunshot wound is that he places his index finger into it. If he can feel the projectile, he stands a chance of removing it. But he can see clearly, and from Nelson's description, he's paralysed. He feels a gush of blood he knows there's very little to be done, that that wound is catastrophic, and so confirms to Nelson that he's sadly going to die. So Nelson is propped against the ship's side on the orlop deck with his retinue, the ship's purser, Walter Burke, who's one of the oldest people, the oldest person on board, in fact, his steward Chevalier, the Reverend Scott, and he is really being then given a running commentary of what is happening, and every once in a while a cheer will go up from Victory's crew, showing that one of the enemy ships has struck, and Nelson becomes quite obsessed with this idea that Hardy, who's a close friend, they've known each other a long time, Hardy has been killed, and he keeps asking for him. Eventually Hardy's able to come below and tell Nelson that things are going well, that none of our ships have struck, and they exchange some talk around the fact that Nelson cannot live, and so on and so forth. Hardy then goes away and returns around 40 minutes later to confirm this wonderful victory. How many ships is Nelson's question? 14 or 15 is Hardy's response. They actually end up with 20 in the end on the day. And Nelson's comment is, I had bargained for 20. And then you get a kind of change in Nelson's thought process here. He does say, and repeats actually, thank God I have done my duty. But this is almost a point where his thought process moves from his responsibility as an admiral to his crew, his ship, his fleet, his country, his king, to the fact he is now on the deck of Victory. He is dying. I'm quite sure he must have been afraid. His thoughts turn to Emma Hamilton, and he talks to Hardy and asks Hardy to make sure that she's taken care of, and he leaves her as an obligation to the state in terms of making sure that she receives a pension. He also talks about his daughter with Emma Hamilton, Horatia, and I think it's at this point that he's really turning to those who are dearest to him, to his loved ones, when he's on the deck and he knows he's dying, that he desires some human touch, some human affection, and that's why he asks Hardy, kiss me, Hardy, and Hardy bends and kisses him on the cheek and stands and pauses in reflection for a few moments and then bends again, kisses him on the forehead this time, and Nelson, who is really very close to death at this point and can no longer see, asks, who is that? And someone remarks, oh, it is Hardy, my lord, and that apparently just becomes too much for Hardy, who is a very good friend of Nelson. He departs the scene. That's the last time he sees his commander-in-chief alive. And Nelson now goes downhill very, very quickly. He's been given sips of lemonade because he's incredibly thirsty and he's very hot. They're rubbing his chest because he finds that eases the pain. And then he asks, or somehow falls and has to be made comfortable, but he's moved onto his right side, and that speeds his death because the blood that had filled the left lung now drains into the right lung and puts that out of action. And he quietly slips away, whispering, depends on the reports, God and my country, or thank God I have done my duty, or indeed drink, drink, rub, rub, fan, fan, as he was having those around him care for him, and he passes away, and that horrendous fact, when it is reported to the fleet, who can see they've obtained a victory, but then learn that Nelson has fallen in the course of that victory, the celebrations, well, don't happen. And indeed, the Prime Minister can't sleep when he hears that Nelson has been killed. The King is rendered speechless when he's told of this battle, of this victory at Trafalgar, but that Nelson has been lost.
Andrew, just quickly, why did Trafalgar matter? 20 enemy ships captured. Why is it seen as this absolutely, landmark naval battle?
There has never been a victory like it before. It comes at a time where things are going pretty badly and continue to go pretty badly on the continent, on land. So it's always nice to have a victory somewhere you can celebrate. And Trafalgar is certainly a very, very big victory. I think it is also hugely important and very relevant to the Navy, because Nelson, who was this exceptionally charismatic and brilliant leader of men, who is, you know, there will never be anyone to match him, I think, as far as the Navy is concerned, falls at the absolute moment of his greatest achievement. And I think those facts combined have really cemented it for the in our national psyche for the last 200 years, and no doubt for the next 2,000 years.
Andrew, it's always such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. It's always great to see you down in Portsmouth. Everyone go and visit the National Museum of the Royal Navy in Portsmouth, HMS Victory. It's the greatest single object in any museum on planet Earth. Thank you for sparing us the time on Trafalgar Day. And it's very exciting news about the new sketch in Nelson's own hand. So congratulations.
Thank you. Always great to be with you.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.